Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts Don Abernathy and Jeff Copsetta.
What is going on? Welcome to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite podcast, or your favorite World War II based podcast, I guess I should say. Now, for 3 years or so, you can say, well, Don, you're one of the only World War II based podcasts. Well, nay. Not that I'm concerned or scared, but there is another new World War II based reenacting podcast out there I saw on Instagram. So there are some other reenactors getting into the game, but that's all right. There's plenty of room for all of us. But joining us, as always, from Texas, Jeff Copsetta. Jeff, how you doing, sir?
Good, Don. Thanks for having me again. And hey, all you listeners.
Hey, all you listeners. And you know what? Jeff was wanting to do this a while back. And we were still playing around with getting all of the logistics lined up. If you're a listener to the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast and you want to show your love and you want to help promote the show, email us at info@WTSPWorldWar2.com or mail call at WTSPWorldWar2.com or reach out to us through our Facebook or on Instagram. Send us a private message. Send us your address and your name and we will send you 100% free, shipping included, What's the Scuttlebutt vinyl sticker so you can put on your car, your truck. The only thing we ask, don't put it on your refrigerator in your garage. Don't put it on your toolbox in the back of your truck because, well, that doesn't help get the word out unless you have a bunch of people in your garage every week going through your refrigerator. You know, obviously shipping and, you know, time and cutting and all that stuff, there's a little bit of a cost involved, which we don't mind consuming as long as it serves its purpose. So if you want to help promote the show and you don't mind slapping a vinyl sticker on your work van, your truck, your car, what have you, your tank, your airplane, I don't care, send us an email at info@WTSPWorldWar2.com. Simply send your name and your address. And if you have a preferable color, we can do any color you want. You can include a color in there because all these are going to be cut to order anyhow. So feel free to send us a color and we'll send one out to you. If you prefer the Lucky Strike logo, say Lucky Strike. If you want the WTSP stenciled logo, we'll send you that. You know, Bob's your uncle. We're here to please you. So by all means, send us any of your requests and all that fun stuff. And by the way, head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com and pick up a shirt. We got the K-Ration breakfast and lunch shirts. We have the lunch and dinner. I haven't rolled the breakfast ones out. And to be honest with you, the reason why I kind of waited on the breakfast one is it's brown, it's squared. It's really not that fancy or fun to look at, whereas the dinner and the lunch shirts are a little more hip and more interesting of a design. But we'll get the breakfast one out there so you can get yourself the full set. And also, you can get the rest of our WTSP World War II podcast shirts over at our website, WTSPWorldWar2.com. And to get the last promotion out of the way, go ahead and sign up for Patreon. Please click on that Patreon link, sign up. It's $1 a month. They take $1 a month out of your bank account, and it goes to support the show and the YouTube channel. And speaking of the YouTube channel, if you haven't done so, please go to YouTube.com, look for Digital 410. You'll find all of our What's the Scuttlebutt video versions of the podcast, as well as all the other nonsense that I'm into. But now that all that annoying and embarrassing stuff is out of the way, Jeff, what has been going on in Texas? It's been about 2 weeks since we've spoken with you.
Yeah, it seems longer than that. I guess we've just had a lot going on. You know, business as usual, inspiring, educating, and honoring our veterans is what I do between my day job and what I volunteer with and how I try to raise my children. But I have a caveat real quick because with your stickers, guys, gals, if you get a sticker, here's a great place to put it. Go to your haircut place.
There you go.
I use two hair cutters. I've got Vinny Todd's in Marble Falls, Texas, VTV. Vincent Todd Van Valkenburg, a guy was an old Christian rock star, guitarist, and he's an awesome barber. He's got a sticker up in his barbershop. And then, of course, I use at Audra McCulloch, who's in Fredericksburg, Texas, which is kind of where I've been. My day job keeps me in Fredericksburg, not the winery, it's the day job. And put a sticker on your haircutter's mirror. You know, a lot of people sit in that chair after you and they're going to ask. And as long as your haircutter's cool with it, it's a great way to spread the word.
Absolutely. You know, I've often thought about going on to the bus stops and tagging those because you got a lot of people sitting there waiting 20, 30 minutes, especially here in the city with nothing to do. But how has COVID affected the way you guys are educating out there in Texas right now?
So it's not slowing anything down. If anything, it's ramping things up. You know, the best way, I mean, let's face it, man, you know, the best way to get to today's youth is through a screen. For you living history reenactors out there, the day will come. We will hit the beach again. Some of you already are. I know I've got a good buddy that just did a really cool Vietnam tactical, I guess you could say, out of state. And so it's starting to come back. But really, digital, virtual, I mean, this is the way. You know, I've heard from like sixth grade teachers that are reaching out to museums like, guys, history is just not pounded into our elementary school kids. Mm-hmm. They get to middle school and it's math and reading and social studies is just kind of a blur. And that's our responsibility. It's our responsibility to not only to educate ourselves about history, but to make sure that our youth has the tools to do that also. And that's what we do. That's why we do it.
And I just had a thought, not to interrupt you, but because of what you were just saying. Now there's actually kind of, and I've never done it, but I know there's a lot of groups out there who take pride and who've put a lot of effort into creating a school-friendly display. Obviously, you can't take a bunch of M1 Garands and M1 Carbines into a school environment, so you got to replace those with more personal effects and things like that. But there are guys who have gone around and who have done presentations at schools, and sometimes it's in a class, sometimes it's in an auditorium. But I just had a thought. If you put in the logistics and the planning like a month or two ahead, can you imagine the size of potential crowd? You can do a Zoom meeting to, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 different, you know, high school classes across the district. You could actually, instead of doing one for one school or one for one class, you could do a Zoom meeting presentation for, you know, 150 kids or more and just blow it all out at one time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are platforms, I know, at least all over Texas, that connect a lot of different schools with museums that do just that, that do a distance learning. They'll carry an iPad around and go through their museum, and it's live. The kids are right there in the classroom, you know, watching whoever that interpreter may be, or you know, living history actor, whatever, and giving virtual tours to museums, showing people what we've got, you know, or what that museum has. And yeah, man, that's how we're going to have to do it. I mean, living history is not, it's evolved, it's changed. And you know, I know, you know, as well as I do, we thrive for that 80, 100 guys all together, you know, ready to do this huge tactical or this huge living history program, especially if you've got a live, you know, audience there. That's mm-hmm. what they came here for. They've traveled from all over to see. It's like an air show.
Yeah,
you can see a plane sitting on the ground. Yeah, great. Look at that. Oh, it's leaking oil. But when you see it buzzing overhead, you know, it's a whole different experience. So, yeah, if you can't get out and go to these air shows, but man, if you can see this stuff virtually, I mean, there's a lot of museums. I mean, you know, I don't know if I talked about it last episode, but you know, there's about 35,000 museums mm-hmm. in this country. That's a lot of museums. And there's a lot of small ones
that are going out of business. We,
exactly.
Speaking of the That's YouTube the channel, back when we had Eric Hauser on the show, probably about 8 episodes back, give or take, he drove down here from Tampa, and he was had just recently retired. He was modern day active duty, and he's also mm-hmm. a reenactor. But to help really justify his drive over here, other than to do a podcast in studios, I took him around Southwest Florida because we have the Iwo Jima statue here that's made from the same exact mold as the original one. We have the Southwest Florida Military Museum and Library. We have a statue over in downtown Fort Myers dedicated to the 82nd Airborne. And so we went around all these different World War II things. And when COVID hit, the Southwest Florida Military Museum and Library, it primarily started out as a small group of veterans, old timers really, who had been through the system, who have gotten proficient with helping other vets get their benefits through the VA, this and that and the other thing. They would provide free meals for any veterans on Wednesday. And they just had this little unit behind Hooters. And what tends to happen is when veterans get older and they tend to die off, sometimes the spouses and the children who either don't have interest or maybe the spouse doesn't feel comfortable with old firearms in the house, they would start donating to this place. And after a couple years, they had so much stuff that they ended up renting out an old grocery store. It was, used to be a sweet bay. And so they primarily operated off of donations. And then it's called Museum and Library because they'd also sell library books and this and that, little trinkets. And, you know, they kept the lights on. But when COVID hit, they hurt bad. And they're just about, I think, sadly, they may be close to getting ready to close up their doors, if not maybe try to downsize back into a smaller facility. Because as you can imagine, the rent on a place that's as big as a full-size grocery. Now, we're not talking like a Walmart, but, you know, an Albertsons, a Sweet Bay, a Winn-Dixie, just whatever the local grocery store is in your neighborhood. Think of the rent on a place that big, and you're operating them with volunteers and, you know, things like that. And so if you know of small museums in your area, please visit them. Sign that book, showing that you showed up, make a donation, because, you know, there's a lot of huge museums out there, but there's a lot of small ones that were just guys like us whose collections got way too big, or a group of guys like us whose collections combined were big enough that they were able to make a small public museum. And those guys are really hurting right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you bring up a good point. All these museums, all these smaller ones that are having to close, their collections are now being donated to larger museums, which is good and bad. You know, it's good because we know it's going to a place that's, you know, less likely to close down, you know, has, you know, great procedures in place. So they wouldn't be a large, you know, museum, a lot of visitation. The downside is large museums typically already have such a large collection that now they inherit another 1,000 artifacts.
That goes in a back stock and no one ever sees it.
Exactly. So yeah, all you listeners, if there's a way you can get involved, I will lead you by example. A week ago, I was just voted in at a local museum right here in the town I live. It's a CAF museum. There's not a lot of museums that the Commemorative Air Force has, you know, within their squadron. So we're really fortunate to have it. And just got voted in as the museum director there, which is big news for me. Hopefully big news for the museum.
Congratulations.
See if there's some way. Yeah, appreciate it.
Do they have a website or a social media imprint you can send people to? You have the addresses off the top of your head?
Yeah, it's Highland Lakes Squadron, something like that.
Put you on the
Highland
spot.
Lakes Squadron Air Museum, something like that. You'll be able to find it. It's on Facebook. I don't think they have anything on Insta, but it's definitely on Facebook. Check us out. It's you know, like I said, it's a pretty small museum, and it's for sure one of those that would be in that bubble of, oh my gosh, it may not ever reopen again. So we've reopened, we're rebuilding, we're, you know, reforming what that museum is going to be for this, you know, it's a small population town that I live in. But man, last Sunday when I was there, we had folks that were traveling from one state to another and Texas was in between. They saw an M60 tank sitting outside and went, whoa, you guys are open. Oh man, coming out, you know, it's great. Yeah, Highland Lake Squadron of the CAF in Burnett, Texas, planning our air show in March of 21. So excited about that. So, you know, like I need something else to do in my spare time, but I can't just sit. I couldn't sit idle.
So when are you going to take a flight in that PT-26? I'm looking at your website right now.
Oh, that's it. That's the PT-19.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it says PT-26. Now, this is the heading, but then it says the PT-19 is our hangar. It's owned by the CAF.
Right.
Yeah, I got you.
Right. Yeah, so we've got that. We've got an SNJ-4, a beautiful aircraft that is airworthy. There's an L-17, and of course, a couple of years ago, unfortunate accident where we lost our C-47, but there's another one coming to us. Hopefully by the air show in March. So we've got another Goonie Bird coming our way. That's going to be the feature aircraft of the squadron. And of course, you know, if folks, if you're in this area, you know, there's a lot more, the Tex Hill wing and, you know, what they've got in San Marcos, San Antonio, there's a lot of little CAF squadrons in this area, you know, for sure. There's a PBJ, which is a Marine Corps B-25 gunship. It's all blue, called Devil Dog. That's based out of Georgetown. That's about 30 miles from here. So, folks, get out. Put your mask on if you have to put your mask on, but go see these museums. Put $5 in the donation bucket because, like Don said, you know, man, this stuff is important. There's a lot of museums that may not ever reopen, and you could be the reason that they do reopen and they do stay open. So do what you can to preserve history.
And that is HighlandLakeSquadron.com. You know, I was asking you before the show. No worries. I was asking about the show about the Merrill's Marauders, and somehow I got into this. I thought you reminded me of it, but now I'm thinking back of it. I think I was reading another book or came across something where it came up. Somehow I ended up going on Amazon and I ordered this little book. It's a cute little book. Not to be cruel to the book. It's only 64 pages, but I've gone and since have ordered another book. And once I read the more in-depth book on the Merrill Marauders, I'll talk about a little bit on the show. But the interesting thing about this book is it goes over like the logistics of the weaponry and all that stuff that's issued. And something caught my eye. One of the things like in the reenacting community that people like to bust other guys' balls for is the use of a Colt 45 on their hip. And they talk about how no one ever, you know, they weren't really issued that widespread. And it had a table of the battalion organization of weapons. Okay, and it includes the battalion headquarters, combat team 1, combat team 2. Not to go too in-depth in this, but just to give you an overall. Between the battalion headquarters, combat team 1, and combat team 2, you're looking at 928 enlisted men, right? And they had 35 officers. And so that's a total of 963 officers and enlisted men. Between all those, they had 139 pack animals because the Marauders were, you know, going through Burma, trying to fight Japan from behind. And so they were out in the woods. So they needed to pack animals to carry their equipment. Machine guns heavy, they had 7, which makes about sense. Machine gun light, they had 6. 60mm mortars, they had 10. 81mm, they had 7. M1 carbines, 181. M1 Garand rifles, 624. Sounds about right. Thompson submachine guns, 102. Browning automatic rifles, 54. You know, between the battalion headquarters, combat team 1, combat team 2, you know how many 45 Colt pistols they had? Just throw a number out there. Out of 963 men, guess how many pistols are floating around that battalion?
Oh, gosh. I would say about 100.
Try 4.
So, 4?
4. And that's, you know, a group of commandos, if you will. That's the Merrill Marauders. 1 battalion, they had 4 Colt pistols. So that just goes to show you how. Now, obviously, we know from watching the Pacific, you know, a lot of the guys had, you know, stuff that they brought from home. And they had a lot more men than the Merrill Marauders. But the Special Forces guys, Combat Team 1 had 2 and Combat Team 2 had 2. Battalion HQ had none. So out of close to 1,000 men, you had 4 Colt revolvers floating around in the woods of Burma. So clearly, at least amongst the Merrill Marauders, they were not used that heavily. And so,
yeah, and of course, you know, when you're reading statistics like that, can always be misleading because what your issue, what's on your TO&E,
sure,
and what's really out in the field, of course, is 2 different things. But you make a great point. I thought there'd been more.
No, right, I was like,
the only reason I went high is because, especially in that environment, I would definitely prefer a revolver over, you know, a 1911. Not that that's a bad weapon, but revolvers typically don't have magazine feed problems.
Yeah, exactly.
A little bit more bendable.
You know, because we focus so much on the Pacific and primarily the Marine Corps, you know, it's interesting to read these guys, seeing them in Burma wearing the Army HBTs because they were an Army battalion. And interesting enough, according to the illustration on here, they did use the cross-flap canteen covers. But this book is actually pretty in-depth. It actually goes as far as saying, you know, they used the light shade green HBT shirts, but more often than not, those guys were preferred the later HBT trousers opposed to the early issue. Another interesting thing is they had a list of basic minimum, but because of the type of work they did and the fact that they sometimes were expected to initially spend 3 months out in the bush, they were basically told, hey, obviously when it comes to ammo and water, you have to carry this, but the rest of it, carry what you want. Carry as much as you want, as least amount, whatever you personally need to survive, you carry. And so they had great leniency on the type of, you know, they even said they could take the haversack, but most of them preferred the early musette bag, and so it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
So before the show, I sent you 2 screenshots. And I don't know if I would consider this a reenacting gig, but, you know, a year ago when I was doing this, I talked about on this podcast and the other, but I didn't get into details. I was just kind of cagey about it because I really didn't know how much of it would come to fruition, how much would end up on the editing room floor. But for those of you guys know, I did some background work, and it's for the Disney Plus series. It was originally slated to be on television. Now, I don't know if this is an indictment on the lack of people watching television now or the indictment on their concern of how well the show would do, but it's now no longer, it was originally done for Smithsonian Network and Disney Plus, but now it's exclusively on Disney Plus right next to Tom Hanks' Greyhound, and that is the TV series The Right Stuff, based off of just like the movie. And the interesting part is when we were recording, making this show, we had to shoot the scenes twice, one where we had the cigarettes in our hand and not smoking them for Disney Plus, and then the other ones where we could actually smoke them. And I really didn't. I did 3 days worth of recording. I did episode one, which is the pilot, and that was the interesting one. I think I spoke briefly of it in the past. I got cast as a naval officer. The scene is we're in Virginia at a naval officer club, bar, if you will. And it's supposed to be a retirement party. They don't get into that in the show, but you just see a bunch of guys drinking and having a good time. And when I was there in my uniform, the second AD, the assistant director, was walking around, the guy who shot this scene. He came up to me. He's like, "Were you in the service?" I was like, "No, sir." He's like, "Well, you just look natural in that uniform." I was like, "Well, this is what I do. I'm a World War II reenactor. I spend my weekends wearing, you know, quote unquote, vintage military uniforms." He's like, "World War II reenacting?" I think it was English. He said, "I didn't know that was a thing." I was like, "Oh, yeah." And he's like, "Well, that's interesting. I'll come back to you later and talk about it." And I just thought he's just being nice to the actors and whatever. And he left and did his director things. And believe it or not, at lunch, he tracked me down and we talked about it for a while. And when we shot the scene, it was in Orlando. It was at a country club. They took the bar at this country club. And it was really cool because this takes place in 1957-ish, 59-ish. It jumps around. And so obviously they had to have set production come in, take down all the modern-day sconces, put up sconces and stuff from the 50s, put in the ashtrays, put in some photos from World War II because a lot of these guys served at that time. And they had these huge panels of LED lights outside the window to make sure it looked like the sunlight was coming in. And in this scene, Alan Shepard comes in and he's talking to one of his NCOs, talking about he wants more flight time. And his NCO is standing at a two-top table in the middle of the bar. I'm actually right next to him, pretending to talk to another guy. And while the show just came out, it's on Disney Plus right now. And I sent you a screenshot before the show. Sorry about that. I had to hit the old cough switch. And as far as background acting goes, seeing this first episode is great. I'm in the background, a majority of it. I'm on the same screen with Jake McDermott, who plays Alan Shepard. I'm right in between the two actors while they're talking. You can see me in the background. And then when they move to the bar, you can still see me in the background. So as far as background work goes, I got a lot of screen time on episode one. And then maybe I'll talk about another episode. But then I went back for episode four. It was New Year's Eve. That episode, I played a NASA employee. And there's a great shot when they're doing the countdown and the camera's up on the stage. And there's all the cast and crew. And you can see my tall ass, my head is just sticking up over the crowd. And we're doing the countdown. And at the end of the episode, they show one of the astronauts' wives leaning up against the bar. And I'm like three people over from her. And kind of like the scene fades out with. So I got a little bit of screen time on that one. But as far as, and the reason I bring it up is how I got into this whole thing was through reenacting. Back when The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel was being recorded for Netflix, some of my reenacting people said, "Hey, they're looking for extras to play 1950 civilians in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel over in Miami. If you're interested, go to this casting company and sign up." I did. Nothing came of it. But when The Right Stuff came around, I got casting requests. Originally, I got casting requests to go play a role as a test pilot trying out for NASA, but clearly my ass is too tall and too old to be playing a test pilot. So I quickly got turned down for that, but then got called back for the naval officer thing. So if you guys have Disney Plus and you go in The Right Stuff and you're watching episode one, right around 14 minutes and 25 seconds, you'll see me drinking and smoking in the background of that naval bar. So check that out And let me know what y'all think of my acting premiere.
So am I going to be seeing you on IMDb anytime soon?
No. You know, it's interesting. I looked at the cast for The Right Stuff, that episode, and there's a lot of people who are uncredited, but those are people who are in the acting guild. Obviously, it'd have to do more. You're basically, with the fact that you had lines in Walking Point, you'll be closer of obtaining a Screen Actors Guild credit long before I would. But I just realized, saying that, we now have a podcast where both hosts have had screen times in cinema and television. So say that.
Well, I was on the History Channel before I did Walking Point.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a fun episode.
What was that History Channel?
Too bad. It was too cool to last. It was called Brothers in Arms.
Oh.
It was Rocco on Vince Vargas and Eli Cuervas from Black Rifle. The basis of the show was that these two veterans ran an armory up in Utah, and they kind of got into restoring and demonstrating kind of these strange one-off military weapons. And one episode that I happened to be in was kind of they cover two weapon systems. One was the flamethrower, which I provided for them, and I'm the client. You know, they restore this flamethrower and we shoot it. And then of course, or he shoots it, Rocco shoots it, before they call me in, the client, to make sure that it's working. And then I come out and I make sure that it's firing the way I want. And of course it's some grand finale. You know, it's always some off the wall stuff. There's mm-hmm. stuff blowing up. And I actually shot like a 30-foot tall inflated blue gorilla with this flamethrower laced with Tannerite.
I'll have to look for that on YouTube.
But the other part of the episode was really slick, because I have kind of an infatuation with the 1928 Thompsons. And it just so happened that this particular episode, even though the footage was shot months before I ever got on set, was they were taking a modern semi-automatic Thompson and customizing it and making it very ergonomic for today's standards and all this custom, you know, Cerakoting and everything. And they presented it to Medal of Honor recipient Clint Romeshek. So that was a really cool episode to be in.
What was his take on seeing that classic firearm all modern day'd out?
Oh, of course, he loved it. you know, they actually put him in the back of a soft Humvee driving around somewhere out in the salt flats or something and shooting at 55-gallon drums of diesel and Tannerite or something. Just blowing stuff up. So, but like I said, you know, that was filmed months before I got there. I didn't get to meet Clint or anything, but hanging out with Rocco and Eli was certainly a lot of fun. I was up there for about 7 or 8 days.
They're in Texas too, right? Or are they in Oklahoma? Black Rifle.
No, they're still in Utah. Oh, Black Rifle moved. Yeah. So no, they were up in Colorado. And as far as I understand it, their headquarters has officially moved to San Antonio.
Nice.
Which is really super cool. That's right down the road from me. You know, that's an hour drive. For all you Black Rifle fans, Eli makes some great videos. He's a really fun guy to hang around. So check out their coffee, you know, if you don't mind saying that.
I just watched their third Halloween video. It's pretty funny.
That's kind of great. Maybe we can get one of those on our podcast one day.
Yeah, that'd be nice, right? Maybe get some Black Rifle Coffee Love up in here.
Yeah, it wouldn't hurt my feelings.
I do know a couple of the guys. I don't know if they still do. I would assume they still do, because after all, you listen to once, you're going to keep coming back. But I know a couple of cats over Grunt Style who worked in the shipping docks were listening to the podcast for a while. So I was excited about that. Yep.
Yeah. Hopefully they still are.
You know, it's wintertime. It's upon us. Well, it's still 90 here in Florida, but next weekend, this weekend obviously is Halloween and all that, but next weekend is one of the events that I've talked about a lot in the past on this podcast, which is VKE, or Von Kessinger Express. And that's the one where it takes place at the Florida Train Museum, speaking of museums. And it's cool because it's not only is it interactive, but we actually have a real train and about 8 to 10 miles of track, and the public comes, they buy train tickets, and when they come, usually in the past, the whole museum is done up in Nazi paraphernalia, and you have the Weimar Republic and SS guys walking around, handing out papers, boarding passes, and doing their propaganda. And as the train goes down the track around mile three, it stops. They go out to execute a American prisoner, in which they're surprised to see the airborne was waiting on them. They have a little skirmish with the airborne. The airborne gets on the train. As the train starts moving, there's a scripted dialogue that takes place between the airborne and the officers telling them to surrender. I got some cool photos on my Facebook page from back in the day where I'm like going through the, and the cool thing is they actually have some civilians there wearing like 1940 civilian garb. And so there's a reenactor who's, he was an old man, but I looked through his suitcase and he actually had printed up documents of the VE rocket and like recording equipment in there. And I'm interrogating him and we're going on asking the real civilians if any paperwork, yada, yada, yada. Train gets down to the other end of the track. We get off and lo and behold, there's the Germans wanting their officers back. And then that's when the big grand finale, the reenactment takes place there. Well, obviously with COVID and all that, that was going to put a big damper on this thing. And which, speaking of museums and how they make their money, between this and the Polar Express that they do around Christmas time, it's basically where the museum makes a majority of the money that they survive off of throughout the year, because that's when they sell the most tickets for these train rides. And so there was great concern about, well, how are we going to do this this year? Well, Florida is 100% open, but there are still some safety suggestions in place. I won't go far saying guidelines. And we're like, well, what are we going to do about mask? Because there's a lot of events, you know, and rightfully so, guys don't feel comfortable wearing masks and this and that. But we got to thinking, instead of doing the normal scripted thing that anybody who goes to this event has witnessed 100 times before, because it's usually all the same, we've changed it up this year. This year, instead of it being a German-occupied train going through France, it is now a German-occupied tuberculosis hospital train. Thus, the civilians wearing face masks. And then we are going to have masks with bandanas, you know, aircraft bandanas over top of them. So that when, and we're going to have a lot less reenactors on the train, but we'll still have the public, you know, reenactments where we're not wearing a mask. But the guys on the train will have facial coverings because they're afraid to get tuberculosis. And so there are ways to reconfigure your stuff. And we actually have some, Paul's doing a great job doing research and actually writing the new, all new dialogue for this thing. And so it'll be interesting. Next weekend will be my first public event, with the exception of what we did up in Largo, Florida at the gun show a few months back. So I'm kind of excited to get back out there and, to reopen up living history and reenactments here in Florida coming up here real, real quick.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Things have just been crazy. It's just, it, you know, I was talking to my brother. I'm like, can you believe it? 2020 is almost over. And can you believe this has been going on this long? What is it? Almost, we're almost 9 months into this insanity and it's still going. It's just so, so crazy. Know. So, you got anything else you want to get off your chest with the fine people before we so casually take them into interview number three, the final interview with Jake Larson, the World War II vet. We're going to get a little bit more into his combat career and then talk about what happened on his long boat ride home and what it was like to come back to the United States in 1945 after being away for 3 years. So stick around. That's coming up next. I think we got all the promotions out of the way. Just one more thing. This episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, as well as all the other podcasts here at the Digital 410 Network, is brought to you by our friends at At Computers. At Computers has been providing IT solutions for all of Southwest Florida since 2004. So even if you don't live in Southwest Florida, they can help you remotely as long as you have internet, obviously. So give them a call at 239-283-1120. That's 239-283-1120. Or head over to act-capecoral.com. And not only can they log in your computer and help you with any issues you're having, they can help you out with two-form authentication, so that if you're trying to log into your work from home or you have employees logging in from home because of COVID, you want that to be done securely. Obviously, with all the work going on from home, there's more security breaches out there. So they can help you out with internet security. And most importantly, online backups. Backup that data. If your hard drive crashes or unfortunately you get encryption, all your data will be safe. So give them a call, 239-283-1120, or head over to act-capecoral.com. Jeff, as always, where can people find you?
Jeff Copsett on Facebook or at Jeff Copsett on Instagram.
Thank you so much, friend. And everybody stick around. And coming up is Jake Larson. And joining us from the phone from sunny California once again, Mr. Jake Larson. Jake, I feel like you and I are becoming good old friends at this point. This is your third interview with us. And you were just telling me before you came on that your life is crazy. You just don't get it. Are you getting requests to do a lot of interviews? Is your, you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I went to a trade school after I got out of the service in 1945. I went to Dunwoody in Minneapolis. I took electricity and air conditioning, motor rewinding. God, there wasn't anything I couldn't do. And
did you ever imagine you'd become a spokesperson for your generation at some point in your life? Do a lot of public speaking?
Never in my... I had to take public speaking when I was in the 10th grade. I couldn't even talk to my class.
Sure. So the last time we were together, we just wrapped up the Battle of the Bulge, and you were telling me that you had something interestingly happen to you on your long travel home, but you said it's quite an in-depth story that we should schedule a third interview, which we are obviously happy to do. So maybe we should pick up right around the time of the ending of the war for you. I guess we'll start nice and clean. Where did you get your notification that the war was over for you and it was time to go home?
There's another. Mine is so different from anybody else. I ran G3 at night, the night shift.
Mm-hmm.
On D-Day, we got to go back to D-Day.
Sure.
And the whole army was running on adrenaline at that time. We loaded on the 4th, expecting to invade Europe on the 5th. Well, that storm came in, and it was postponed till the 6th.
What does that do for morale? I mean, here you guys have been training for years. Some of these guys have been training for 3 years. You take that long boat ride across seas. You're doing more training. The orders come down. Okay, we're moving. At some point, you have to find a little quiet time. I'm sure you basically have to accept fate. Okay, here we go. Tomorrow's the big day. Like you said, you're running off adrenaline, coffee, and cigarettes. And then all of a sudden, the thing gets scrubbed. How does one rebuild morale after that? I mean, because now you got to go through it all over again. A second night of, oh boy, tomorrow's the day. What does that do to a guy?
How would you feel in front of all your buddies there? Everybody is putting on a front.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? And when you put on a front, you boast everybody. So we're all in it together. There was no down. No down. We wanted it done and over with. We wanted to get it over. We wanted to go home.
Sure.
I was overseas for 2.5 years there, you know. And we knew we had an invasion in our plans, but we wanted to get it over with. The prolonging of that thing, and they kept bringing supplies from the United States. I thought England would sink from the amount of supplies they had. You cannot imagine the millions of things that came over. All kinds of guns, tanks, airplanes. I don't know how they got them all made. Trucks, loaded with trucks. It's just unbelievable supplies.
Yeah, I think the logistics officers are some of the biggest unsung heroes of the war. I mean, just the logistics alone. Let's forget the fact that you guys are going to war and all the things that are going to come. just the idea of coming out of a depression era, building all this new equipment, but getting it overseas via ships, via anything that floats with a motor, and just that in itself, getting it done with the least amount of confusion. I'm sure that things got misplaced and things didn't land exactly where they're supposed to, but even still, the amount of effort to go into that, and then to have the VE mail separated and that being getting priority as well, just the logistics of the war and what those logistics officers were able to do is just still, to this day,
it is
mind-boggling.
It's unbelievable to people that haven't seen anything like that. And we were right in on the whole doggone thing. It's how did they ever manufacture all those gigantic planes? Those B-17s, you don't put those together, just snap your fingers.
Not at all. And, you know, I have the privilege up in Tampa Bay, about 2 hours from me, they have the USS American Victory Liberty ship. And I've had the privilege to participate in events on that ship while it's out on Tampa Bay. And when you're standing down there on the dock in front of that thing, it blows your mind of the size of that. But then to realize that that's nothing in comparison to the other ships, and to think that you and your friends and the people of your generation are standing on one of these ships, and you look out and you're just surrounded by miles and miles and miles.
Miles material, yeah.
The world will never see that again in its lifetime. And it's just photos of the day just don't even give it even remotely, you know, the gravitas of what that situation was.
Well, that is and will be the largest enterprise ever done in the world. That D-Day, 1944, January 6th, or June 6th, 1944. There will never be anything. 7,000 ships participated. 7,000.
That's insane.
And I don't know if I told you this, but I worked on the D-Day invasion for Omaha Beach. The ships that we were assigned, and each one had a different number of people. I typed every one of those guys' name. And for the work I did on that there, I got the Bronze Star.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, you know, the young kids nowadays, typing on a computer keyboard is nothing. Well, you're talking about a spring-loaded, heavy-keyed stamping typewriter. And that wasn't a common skill for people back then, unless you were in, you know, the secretary pool. Do you remember what your words per minute was back then?
My what?
Your words per minute. How fast you could type?
I could type 50 words a minute. And that's about what those typewriters were good for.
Yeah.
They weren't made for speed. They were just we did a lot of stencils.
Yeah.
With a lot of ribbon. See, yeah, cut the stencil. That's a kind of a paraffin coated thing, and those stencils were used on mimeograph. You probably don't remember that stuff. But all that stuff was printed with mimeograph. And so I used to cut all those stencils. And if you made a mistake, you had to
start all over.
Yeah, it's quite a thing. But I was blessed making no mistakes. I didn't even have anybody checking my stuff. To think of it now, I don't know how we do it. just a full bird colonel and I in there working on that.
I'm sure you would have the echoes of the reverberation of those letter on the typewriter, of those letterheads slapping that ribbon. That just had you're probably trying to, well, sleep at night or during the early hours, whichever time you actually had the chance to lay your head down. You probably just had the sound of that typewriter reverberating through your head at all hours. I couldn't imagine.
And then when we were in the bowels, I ran one of those electric battery-operated typewriters. That's a teletypewriter.
Mm-hmm.
You're connected by landline to your divisions that was under you or anybody that... They had one just like it.
Sure.
If I started that up, it would operate theirs. So I could send messages over to them. Of course, everything was sent in code. You sent messages 5 letters at a time. Think of it. 5 letters at a time. XDREF or something like that. And then enough space, and another 5 letters. And you had to type them at 45 words a minute without slowing down or stopping.
And so not only are you typing 45 words a minute, but you're not even typing your natural English. You're typing code. I can only imagine how long the training had to take for that.
It is something you just can't just sit down and do.
Sure.
A couple weeks really. But I was proficient on the typewriter, too.
Sure.
Yeah.
So before I diverted the conversation, you were talking about, you know, we went back to D-Day, and we were kind of talking about how you're prepared to go on June 5th, but because of the storms, it got moved a day. And so let's pick up there.
All right. We knew we were going to go in the morning, so I was on that command ship, too. And I lost the name of it right there in my mind.
No worries.
But anyway, Eisenhower was on there, Bradley, and my full bird colonel, who was G3, he was in charge of Omaha Beach for his operations, Colonel John G. Hill. So I was the operations sergeant. You don't find many operations sergeants in the service. And I happened to be one of those birds. And I had to go in with the 1st Division because I was supposed to pick out the command post. Well, all hell broke loose. We could not go at our regular time. I was supposed to go in there at 8 o'clock or something. And here we went around in circles, waiting to get the word to land. The Germans were putting up a resistance. They wouldn't let anybody get up over the cliff. So it was probably pretty close to 10 o'clock before we got the thing that we were going. And when we did get in, there was hardly anybody moving. And they had shipped in some Bangalore torpedoes, and they opened up this ravine. A trench like water came down, and that's where we were supposed to get up over that cliff. It was loaded with barbed wire and stuff, and they shoved these Bangalore torpedoes up in there and screwed them together. And two of the guys that were doing that at the time were killed right there. Germans shot him. And, God, I remember that just like yesterday. And, of course, if somebody goes down, there's always somebody to do the work again. Another takes your place. That's the thing about the Army and the infantry and all that stuff. It's there's always somebody there. You're dispensable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how else to put it, but when you're in the service like that, you become dispensable. There's always somebody can take your place. And when they finally got those Bangalore potatoes in there and set them off, my God, that cleared all that barbed wire out of there. That's when the Germans cleared out from the back of their armament where they were shooting at us. They have no protection from the rear. They're wide open. So they cleared out. It's just like open season there for space.
Yeah. Well, you know, that barbed wire is kind of their last line of defense. You know, they didn't expect, you know, you guys to make it that far in. You made it past the Hedgehogs. You made it past all the MG-42s, the MG-39s. And then you made it up past the barbed wire. And as we all know, because Hitler sent most of his men and tanks up north because he thought Patton's army was coming up north.
Yeah, thank God for that. You see, it's little things like that you put together. And that's the reason I'm sitting here talking to you right now. Think of it. I was in infantry. I was started off in infantry. I got the headquarters company. I got transferred over in North Ireland. I got transferred into G3. How many people do you think ever get out of the infantry into corps, headquarters, and then work on that stuff? I got the Bronze Star for what I did on that. And think of it. I, at 97 years old right now, I'll be 98 in December, December 20th, I'm turning 98. I am the only one alive in all the units that I was in over there. Think, and here I am, now 97 years old. I don't have an ache or a pain in my body.
That's beautiful.
How is that possible? How is that possible?
You did something right.
No, somebody is helping me up from above. I know it. I know it. This is too unreal. And I tell some of these stories on TikTok. So it's amazing. A little old farm boy from Hope, Minnesota has gone through this here. Why did this happen to me? Why am I still here? Well, somebody wants me here to tell my story. And I think we'll have my book out this year yet.
Yeah, that's what you're saying the last time you're on. You guys still have a working title for that, or have you hammered out a...
Oh, I got a title for it, yes. The Luckiest Man in the World. Nobody else has got that title.
Nope.
No one.
I was having a thought when you were talking, when we were discussing about...